Thank you very much, Mark. Now, you'll have detected that the theme of this 2 days is lessons of the crisis of various kinds. And because I had this role chairing the Independent Commission on Banking in the UK, my chunk is going to be on lessons for banking reform. And we've got an hour. I'm very happy for this to be, even though I've got this lectern, if you've got questions as I go along, please chip in. And if I'm running behind time, I'll just manage that. But we can have a bit of to and fro, and I hope I'll leave some time for discussion at the end. Now, my plan is broadly in these terms. I want to begin by setting out some background, first of all, about some aspects of the financial crisis. And in particular, I mean, the UK probably didn't have the worst crisis, but we did have a particularly bad crisis. And we are still living through that in ways that I'll explain. And the lessons I'll be talking about, I thought I should ration to two, and they're both about banks. There are many lessons from the financial crisis that are not about banks. They're about shadow banks. They're about the need for macroprudential regulation, which Stan was talking about earlier on. So I'm going to talk about the structural issue and the loss absorbency issue. That's lessons one and two. I say I rationed to two lessons on banks. You might think, and especially with Hyun here, well, what about the need for better regulation of liquidity? If I had had a third lesson about banks, that would have been the next on my list, but time didn't allow all that. And more generally, it's one thing to have a liquidity problem when the banks are basically solvent, and then central banks can do fairly orthodox lender of last resort liquidity insurance. But you get the really vicious liquidity problems are when lesson two has not been learned and you have a solvency problem as well. I'll be viewing this through the lens of the work of the Independent Commission on Banking. I'll say a little bit about how we operated. It's too grand to call it the political economy of how we operated, but we were given this job. We're independent, that's the I in ICB. But you're clearly in a political process, and all we did was to produce a report, which is just words on lots of pages. And how that does or does not translate into political, legislative, and market consequences, that's all quite interesting. And I'd be very happy to discuss that if people wish to. So it'll be through the lens of that process. But towards the end, because we're now more than a year since the ICB wrapped up, and a lot has happened in the last year. Indeed, even in the last month, we had the draft legislation published by the government. So there, you know, you see it in statutory language. And very interesting developments in Europe. A year ago, I would not have expected a serious debate in the EU generally about reform to banking structures. But that's exactly what we now have as a consequence of the report of the expert group set up by the European Commission, chaired by Governor Liikanen of the Bank of Finland, which reported exactly a month ago. So this is going to be about the year since the ICB. It's going to be about Europe as well as the UK, and that's the plan. So the UK's bad crisis. I mean, first of all, just to set the scene, and this will be very, very familiar to maybe everybody here, but I think it bears emphasis. Banks are unbelievably important, not just in economic life, but in everyday life, in social life, how the world works. So they're absolutely fundamental to payment systems, to the store of value function of money, deposit taking. They are, to varying degrees in different economies, but very centrally in the UK and most of Europe, they are central to lending, whether it's to the household sector, through mortgages and otherwise, credit cards, personal loans, to businesses of all sizes. The largest businesses can directly tap the capital markets, but small and medium-sized businesses, in the UK at any rate, find that very difficult, and indeed in lending to governments in some economies. So banks are absolutely fundamental to that, and the threat of the banking system falling over is therefore absolutely horrendous, and yet, as Stan was explaining in the lecture yesterday and otherwise, you know, people were looking over the edge of that abyss after the collapse of Lehman, and at various points in the subsequent several months. And that was all well before the euro crisis really got going in consequence of these actions. So although they're incredibly important, banks are also, depending how they are structured and regulated, can be very sensitive to economic shocks. They engage in maturity transformation, so in short, they borrow at much shorter maturities on average than they're lending. So they, you know, I can get my money out of my current account within an hour if I want to, whereas that may be funding 25-year mortgages. So banks are at risk, and indeed we're seeing in the Eurozone that member states can be at risk of kind of liquidity hijacks when there's a loss of confidence or whatever, and if there's a great extraction of liquidity on one side of the balance sheet, that can put banks into major trouble. And separately from that liquidity issue, banks, compared with other firms in the economy, are amazingly highly levered. The proportion of owners' equity in their funding structure is typically, I mean, very much single-digit percentage points, sometimes like 2-3%. Amazingly little equity. And there are measures to reform that. And why does it happen? It's partly because deposits are a big slab of bank funding. That it varies enormously from bank to bank, but that might be half of a typical bank's funding. Some banks it will be way more. So you've got these amazingly important institutions which are exposed to risk and to shocks, which have had a very thin layer of equity capital and are at risk of these liquidity attacks if confidence dropped. And we saw all these points come together the way the crisis unfolded. Now here's a look at numbers as they were a few years ago. It hasn't changed greatly, showing the ratio of the assets of banks in various countries, all European countries except Japan and the US, which you see there, as a proportion of GDP. Now, since this was done, we've had both the numerator and denominator go down a bit, but the ratio hasn't changed hugely. And you see among that group of countries that the UK has a ratio of about 5. So the UK bank balance sheets, 5 times GDP. And you've got individual banks, got of our big 4, 3 of them have balance sheets of pretty much the size of GDP. So these are collectively and individually enormous institutions. So if ever you have a kind of home of the too big to fail problem or a prime exemplar, then the UK is certainly one. Another is Switzerland, where you've got 2 gigantic banks. Swiss banks like ours are very engaged in international business. If you'd had Iceland there, or if you'd had Luxembourg, you'd have gone through not even this beautiful ceiling. Well, maybe not quite, but you got close. But this is a very high ratio. Compare it with the US, and depending how you measure these things, you get numbers. Sometimes it's 0.8, sometimes it's 1.2, but US banking system is roughly the size of US GDP. That's a much, much lower ratio. It's partly that the US is a much bigger economy. I mean, it's, you know, half a continent compared with the UK. It's also because non-bank financing is relatively more important in the US than in the UK, so direct access to capital markets, then for households, money market mutual funds rather than bank accounts. So it's that's another reason why you've got an important difference there. But it just means that if the banking system's working well, the upside to the UK economy from that sector is huge, but if things go wrong, then the downside is can be appalling. This is a chart you see in lots of talks based on Bank of England data showing the evolution of bank leverage. This is the ratio of the size of the bank balance sheet, say the asset side, to bank equity capital. This goes back 50 years. That ratio was about 20 for the bulk of that period, which corresponds, obviously, so equity capital is 5% of the balance sheet. You might think, well, even that seems a bit risky because you've only got to lose, most of that 5%, and your bank is in big trouble. But you see how that number doubled in the decade running up to the crisis. So we had some banks, some well-known high street names, going to 40 or 50 times leverage, where you had equity capital just 2% of the asset side. And you might think, how on earth did that happen? How was that allowed to happen? And we'll see as we go along some reasons for that. But it meant, if you think of the peak of that in 07, when the crisis got going, the summer of that year, you had an amazingly thin layer of equity capital to absorb losses. And as we will see, that the other ways banks finance themselves, say through issuing debt as well as by taking deposits, this wouldn't have mattered so much if the debt had been good at absorbing losses. But when the crunch came, when everything hit, the debt holders bore amazingly little of the pain. A lot of debt holders, i.e. they bought bank debt, bondholders in the banks, they got back 100 pence in the pound, 100 cents on the dollar, 100 cents on the euro. So you had this very thin equity layer and a very brittle debt structure. How had the leverage grown so much? Well, this is, it's not all the asset side. This is essentially the UK bit of the balance sheet. There's a lot of overseas bit. This goes back 25 years. The bottom purple slab is UK bank lending to the UK household sector. So that's predominantly mortgages by value, but not only. That grew as a percentage of GDP over this period, partly reflecting the real terms growth relative GDP of house prices, to which mortgages are very linked. But it didn't grow enormously. The black slab in the middle is loans by UK banks to non-financial corporates. Again, that grew as a percentage of GDP quite significantly over the period, but not massively. And the huge growth was the pink at the top, which was the UK bank lending to other financial companies. So this is a dimension of interconnectedness. This is banks lending to other financial companies. And you could have comforted yourself by this. You could have said, well, we've got this ever more intricate parceling out of risk in the financial system. It's a thoroughly good thing that you have this interconnectedness between financial institutions. But as we learned to our cost, there were some very large downsides of that. Another point to note about this, there's a lot of discussion now about banks deleveraging. Just a glance at that will show there's quite a lot of scope for banks to reduce their aggregate leverage ratio by shrinking the pink. I mean, if you got the ratios back even to where they were in the mid-90s rather than in the mid-noughties, that could give you a lot of deleveraging without necessarily squeezing lending to the real economy, by which I mean the household sector and the non-financial corporate sector. So we were in, it's very easy with hindsight, but we were in very bad shape to weather the storm that came. US subprime was a massive shock. I would not put it in the category of perfect storm myself. And for me, the most shocking thing about the crisis was the utter lack of resilience of the financial system to that shock. Instead, you had propagation mechanisms and cascades going through the system, which almost seemed to amplify that shock rather than not. As Dan was saying in the lecture yesterday, when Lehman went down, that was a, you know, in some perspective, medium-sized bank. But the consequences of that, AIG, Freddie and Fannie, all those things, and it ripped through very rapidly through to the UK because of the massive global exposures and the massive financial exposures. And this is all the business about derivatives and securitized things and slicing and dicing risk and all that. You had high street names like RBS would be the principal example, which were in absolutely massive trouble in very little time after these shocks hitting. And as well as interconnectedness from one institution to another, you also had, if you have a universal bank doing everything globally, retail banking, investment banking, trading, market making, all on the same book, you've got a lot of unbroken channels of interconnectedness within institutions as well as between them. So you had massive government bailouts. I think the UK was reasonably good at facing up to the scale of the problems. You had enormous injections through various central bank schemes authorized by the Treasury and so on, huge injections of taxpayer resources to make sure that the system didn't go down, not just lender of last resort, market maker of last resort, and all the rest of it. We now have Royal Bank of Scotland, more than 80% state-owned. Lloyds, TSB, more than 40% state-owned. So this was a massive and necessary reaction. We've had, the macroeconomic consequences have been very hard in the UK. On the left panel there, that's the track of GDP. The dotted line is purely mechanical. It's what if the pre-crisis trend, which incidentally had been going on for about 15 years, had continued. We had GDP growth of not quite 3% a year, but in the upper twos. And instead of doing that, GDP from its peak in 07-08 dropped about 6%. And even now, the last little perky uptick, that's the GDP number from a couple of weeks ago, but even now we are below where we were when the crisis hit. So we're still 3 percentage points below peak output of 5 years ago. And even though that trend, even in a benign world, I doubt we'd have continued on exactly the dotted line, but even if you shade that down a bit, we're reasonable view, we're 10 percentage points or something like that below where I think it's reasonable to think output would have been, which is a huge and now a multi-year output loss relative to what potential had been. I mean, a very interesting question is how the crash knocks the path of potential output, not just actual output. The right panel is unemployment. If you knew the left but not the right, I think you'd imagine that unemployment had gone up to 4 or 5 million. We've actually had a relatively benign labor market outcomes. We've had a million jump in unemployment in the year the crisis really hit, but then it's kind of flattened and is now trending down. And because of labor force growth, employment is has proved quite strong. You put the two together, we've got a huge productivity puzzle. Productivity has been flat, labor productivity, over about a five-year period, which is extremely unusual. And a lot of previous crises have been deeper than ours was. We only had a sort of 6% drop, but we've had sort of very, very little rebound. And this is a massive puzzle. It may be that some of the GDP numbers get revised in the coming releases, but there's no reason to think they'd be anything like large enough revisions to explain that productivity puzzle, which a lot of people are thinking about. And then the fiscal consequences of all this have been pretty dire as well. We started off pre-crisis with a fairly stretched fiscal position. I mean, we had not followed the advice Stan gave yesterday that, you know, the good times you want to get yourself in a nice, safe fiscal position so you can be really Keynesian when the need comes. We got ourselves in a fairly stretched position, and in 1 year we had a more than 10% of GDP fiscal deficit, which is, you know, slowly coming down, but it makes the sort of Keynesian dilemma of how much austerity you do at what pace, or do you expand, really very, very acute when you have that starting point. Our debt to GDP ratio is considerably lower than many economies. We're well below 100 at the moment, but if you're adding 10 percentage points a year, that climbs pretty fast. So onto the two lessons. That's preamble. I'll begin with some remarks just summarizing how the ICB worked. We had an election in May 2010. The incoming government was very committed to reforming the financial regulatory architecture. So this is all the business about taking most of the FSA's functions and moving them back into the Bank of England, or in the case of macroprudential regulation, creating a new style of regulation which will sit in the Bank of England. And then the FSA is moving to this so-called, there's this Twin Peaks model where you've got prudential regulation, that's moving to the Bank of England, and then a financial conduct authority looking at market integrity, market conduct, competition, consumer issues, things of that kind. So that's the regulatory architecture. But there had been relatively little discussion about how to reform the banks themselves. And as I've tried to stress, for the UK, this is a really first order of importance set of issues. There had been very important initiatives of international reform. The Basel process and the development of I'll be referring to these, the Basel III capital standards and related to that liquidity standards and so on. the Financial Stability Board, then the EU developing its regulations, partly to implement Basel measures, partly to do its own thing in various areas, remuneration, etc., etc. At national level, probably the two most striking have been the US, where you had quite speedy primary legislation in the Dodd-Frank Act, which was enacted in July, I think it was, 2010, so a few weeks actually after we had been set up, though we're now into the years of regulatory rulemaking under that legislation. And the Swiss, I'd highlighted how they've got these two mega banks, huge in relation to their economy. They had had a commission, operated in a different way to ours, but that had come out recommending not structural change, but much, much greater capital and loss absorbency for their big banks. So we were set up 5 or 6 weeks after the election here, which had resulted in a coalition government. You see the colleagues I had there as commissioners, who were absolutely fantastic. This was the, I've never worked so hard, but I've never been involved in such an enjoyable project as this. And we had a fantastic support team, who in a way were just as much members of the commission in some respects, who were drawn from Treasury, Business Department, Bank of England, FSA, etc. We were given 15 months, and we published our report in September 2011. Our job was to look at structural and, quotes, related non-structural measures to promote two things. One is stability, which I'm going to concentrate on today. The other is competition, which I'm not going to say anything about until and unless it comes up in questions. And one of the particular things we were asked to look at, which the Lib Dem bit of the coalition were quite keen on, was the, I think it was called, the complex question of whether and how to introduce some form of separation between retail banking and investment banking. We had to have regard to a lot of these. There's a list of other things here. Competitiveness, a lot of the lobbying when we were set up was the alleged threat we posed to the competitiveness of the City of London, so a lot of lobbying on those lines, which we tried to deal with. Fiscal issues were very important in our thinking, and we interpreted that very much as trying to get a set of measures that would get the taxpayer off the hook, which the taxpayer is currently manifestly on in relation to the bank. So that was the task. We interpreted related non-structural measures particularly to refer to capital and other loss absorbency measures. And that's why my two lessons are going to be structural and capital related. One thing we did in our process, sorry, just to explain the timeline. So we began in June 2010. In September, we put out an issues paper, which was, in a sense, our interpretation of our remit. We said, we think it means this. We're going to focus attention on this, 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 not this, this, this. I was keen not to have remuneration questions in the sector, things we looked at, A, because loads of other people were looking at that, and it was also a tremendously political issue, which I think could have cut across our independence. I was keen we not do that. April 11, we did an interim report, which where we set out this this ring fencing idea, which others had been talking about as well. That very much framed the debate for our closing 4 or 5 months till we came up with the final conclusions. I felt it was too long to go from September 2010 to April 2011 in radio silence, so there was a good speaking opportunity at London Business School in January 2011 where there are those speeches which you know well, so where in a sense they don't say anything at all, but in a sense they say quite a lot. So it was aiming to do that, and that shaped the quite a lot of discussion that followed from that. So that's how we handled it. So I'm boiling this down to two dimensions, which is sort of scandalous, but it gets to the essence of it. So we were focusing on these two dimensions, the structural reform question, which could range from do nothing to have complete separation between retail banking and investment banking somehow defined. The other dimension, loss absorbing capacity. That means equity capital to absorb losses, and it means trying to get bank debt loss absorbent. So in a future crisis, the bondholders don't get back 100 pence on the pound. They might get back 50p on the pound, or they might have their debt converted into equity capital, that kind of thing. And very, very schematically, we our feeling was that if you go super radical on one dimension but do nothing on the other, that would just not be a satisfactory package. So had we gone radical on split, have total separation, but done nothing beyond the, in my view, pretty low internationally agreed baselines for capital, then I think you would have had major risks to the UK taxpayer remaining in UK retail banking. If, on the other hand, you'd done nothing about structure but piled up capital requirements across the whole of UK banks, I think you wouldn't have been shielding UK retail from a lot of global and investment banking type risks. There was a, you know, there's an opportunity to create some kind of firewall here, and if you do nothing on structural reform, you miss that. And we remember, we were recommending for one country, the UK, taking the rest of the world as given, albeit in the context of a somewhat fluid international debate, which we were conscious we were reflecting from and also in some ways playing into. But if you get one country going it alone, saying our capital requirements are 20%, the rest of the world is on 7, then you really will have geographical arbitrage risks of banks moving operations out of the UK. Now, that's not a reason to say, oh, we can't do anything because competitiveness means we've just got to follow what the rest of the world does. But there is a limit to what one country can sensibly do, particularly, I'd say, on the investment banking side, where relatively small differences in regulatory requirements can have a big effect on location decisions. Retail, you don't get that so much because it's quite hard to do UK retail banking anywhere other than in the UK. So we were sort of in the crosshairs of that schematically. We would see our packages relatively pretty radical, but it wasn't super radical in either dimension. So our main recommendations were ring fencing of retail banking, which I'm going to spend a little while detailing. The basic idea is that you have a separate entity that does retail banking. It can coexist with other kinds of banking, say within a bank holding company structure. So it's not total split. It's not saying that the owner of a retail bank is not allowed to own any other kind of bank, but it's saying you've got a separate legal entity subsidiary within a structure. It has its own board, it has its own capital, it has lots of rules on how it may not do things in relation to the rest of the bank, but it can coexist in that wider group. And then we had a whole string of things to try and improve loss absorbing capacity. We tried to do all this very much with the grain of the evolving international agenda, but in some respects we certainly went beyond the internationally agreed baselines, and very deliberately so. Now, what's the point of ring fencing? Well, we would see several advantages. One is the insulation advantage. Remember I said at the beginning that banks are providing these absolutely essential economic and social or services to society. What happened in the crisis was that, partly because of the nature of banking groups, you had this shock being propagated almost in an amplified way through the system. And even though it was emanated from somewhere else, it and its consequences were putting UK high street banking at risk. And for that, there's a sort of continuity of service imperative. Doesn't mean that the bank has to continue, but the services, I think any government with the ability to protect that will do so. And because we had totally unstructured universal banking, you had the UK government drawn into rescuing gigantic, you know, mega banks doing all sorts of activities all around the world, like RBS, and it couldn't have a targeted policy intervention. It had to shoulder the whole thing. Now, ring fencing doesn't, there are no silver bullets, doesn't do anything perfectly, but it, in our view, gives you a very important degree of insulation of UK retail from certain kinds of external shock. You can still have shocks in the domestic economy which directly hit retail banking. That's not an insulation point, that's a separate point. But the a big category of shocks, if you like the imported shocks, ring fencing will give you an important degree of insulation from. If nevertheless you have the next crisis come along, if you've got structured rather than unstructured banks, then governments can, they've at least got the option to have different approaches for different banking activities. Instead of saying, oh, we've got to shoulder the whole lot of RBS, you could say, right, well, we're going to do this for RBS's UK retail banking, but we're going to have this very different approach for its trading book, for its US operations, etc. And ring fencing gives you structure where you can, in particular, address issues where you've got the service continuity provision. And you can have a much smarter and more effective set of tools for resolution. Resolution is the orderly handling of crisis. Another benefit of ring fencing, as we saw it, was, and it goes to this point about being one country in a wider world, ring fencing means you can have higher capital requirements for retail banking than investment banking. Now, you might think, well, that sounds crazy, because surely retail banking is safer than investment banking. But it's not crazy if you think about, this is one country, the UK, trying to combine much greater resilience of its retail banking, domestic banking, but in a world where it for good reason, wants to remain a preeminent financial center in the time zone. So ring fencing and the separate legal entity doing retail with the separate capital buffer, you could have a higher buffer there than while letting international standards, subject to caveats, apply to international activities. And finally, and I haven't yet defined how the ring fencing we proposed will work, you've got a framework for lending to the real economy. Remember that the purple and the black slabs in that diagram. So we think it gives a good framework for that. Question is, how do you design it? A lot of people, when we floated this in April 2011, said, well, that's all very well, but the devil is in the detail, which I think was precisely the correct response. It was a perfectly welcome response from our point of view. There are two aspects to design. One is the where do you draw the line issue between retail and wholesale slash investment banking, and the other is how strong is the fence. Now, on the where to draw the line, we favoured an approach with a degree of flexibility, where some things here called mandated services, in the draft legislation they're called core activities. The word core is used. And this is deposits from individuals and small and medium-sized enterprises. That goes exactly to the store of value function of bank deposits and the payment system aspect, and overdrafts linked to such accounts. Those on our scheme can only happen in the ring-fenced entity. Lots of things may not happen there. They are excluded or prohibited from it. And you see there the list on the right. The way the government said it, proposing to do it in the draft law, is that they have two, the prohibited thing in the law has two things. There's excluded activities and there are prohibitions. And the excluded activity in the draft law is dealing in investments as principal. So that covers trading, underwriting, market making, a whole swathe of things. And then through the prohibitions, the government will keep non-European activities out of the retail bank and large exposures to other financial companies. But there's a whole load of things in the middle. Lending to corporate customers that are not financials of any size within Europe, taking deposits from them, and so on. And our logic didn't dictate that should be necessarily in or necessarily out of the retail bank. So that was left flexible, which has the further advantage that if you're too rigid on design, you could do things like trap all the deposits in one place and the lending opportunities in another, which would be sort of crazy. You have to have flexibility on at least one side of the balance sheet, and our scheme would allow it on both. If you applied that to a snapshot of how things were a couple of years ago, the mandated is the purple. That would be approaching one-fifth of the balance sheet, so roughly one multiple of GDP. The prohibited would be approaching two-thirds. That reflects just how great are the the exposures to other financials of the UK banks, the trading, market making, derivatives, underwriting, etc. And it shows how much outside European business is conducted by our banks, which is fine, provided it doesn't pose a threat to the UK economy and fiscal position. And that would be approaching another fifth. So you'll see that most would be in the prohibited, excluded category, and then roughly between a fifth and a third or so would be the slice of balance sheet, this is on the asset side, that you would have in the ring-fenced entity. How strong is the fence? Got to be very strong or there's no point doing it. So you need, there are legal issues, there are capital issues, there are liquidity issues, there are points about exposure rules within a banking group, and essentially we were saying the retail entity can't have dealings with it, with its parent bank or with siblings within the group any greater than it would be allowed to have under standard regulatory rules with third parties. That's to stop it being undermined. There are issues about governance, the composition of the board, the duties of the board, the reporting requirements, and so on, which our final report said quite a bit about. Now, frequently asked questions. One, which is becoming, is getting louder and louder in the UK, is why not go the whole hog and have a full breakup, a full split? I think it's fair to say when we started off, the debate was between do nothing and do something. Now, and it's, I think, partly a consequence to scandals like LIBOR, to the mis-selling issues around PPI and other things, there are a lot of voices who are saying that the issue shouldn't be do nothing versus ring fencing, it should be ring fencing rather than full breakup. And the reason we did not, and with hindsight, still do not recommend a full breakup, they are several. First, the costs of a full breakup, not just for the banks, but for the economy as a whole, I think you do lose synergies, you do lose diversification benefits if you go for a full split. I think a very important point is that with ring fencing, where you can have a UK retail bank sitting within a wider international group or a group doing investment banking as well, is that there are some imaginable crises which are domestic in nature, and it might well be better for financial stability and better for the UK taxpayer to have UK retail banks sitting in wider groups where the resources of the wider group could mitigate, maybe even mop up entirely, a domestic banking crisis than not to have that. Because if you were to go for total split, you would then create a UK retail banking sector of very similar looking entities. A lot of correlation between them. They would be standalone. They might have high capital buffers, but they wouldn't have recourse to private sector resources elsewhere. And to put it mildly, it's not at all obvious that that gives you better financial stability. So the move to a full breakup, I think it's a fallacy to think, ah, oh, that's just doing ring fencing seriously. I think you lose a lot as you go to that. Synergy benefits, and you may be scoring an own goal rather than a positive goal in terms of financial stability. Now, banks might themselves, if they're faced with ring fencing, and in particular if that does curtail the government guarantee, the taxpayer backstop to investment banking activities, it is conceivable that some would choose to split themselves up and say we would do better, it'd be better for our shareholders to have a separate retail bank, float that off or keep that and float off investment banking. That would be up to the banks, and that would be fine if they did that. We weren't seeking to induce that, but if we succeeded, if a plan like this succeeds in shifting incentives, some might do that. That seems to me would be perfectly fine. And much better they make those decisions with undistorted or less distorted incentives arising from the government backstop. So in a nutshell, and this is a point, I've got a lot of European discussions in the last year. I thought I was all done in September a year ago, but the European debate got going. A lot of continental Europeans wanting to protect universal bankings see the ICB as a threat to that. And I say, absolutely not. We are for structured universal banking rather than unstructured universal banking. And we are not full splitters. Another linked question having regard to the US, where the Volcker Rule is part of the Dodd-Frank legislation, is proving a nightmare to define and implement. The Volcker Rule is the idea that you ban from a deposit-taking institution proprietary trading. This is sort of own account trading, not done for a customer, but done for the bank's own account. That should be separated off. We thought about that. We took Paul Volcker very kindly was coming through London, and we had a hearing with him and some informal conversations too. We were not attracted to the Volcker Rule for the UK, partly because it didn't go anywhere, in our view, anywhere near far enough. If you go back to this pie chart, the Volcker Rule, I mean, I don't quite know what you can define it in so many different ways, but I think that might have been a possibly 5 to 10% wedge taken out. So it would have been largely universal banking minus a little slice. And in our view, that gave inadequate protection, insulation to retail banking in the UK context. We were also very conscious, and I think events in the US are proving this, just the difficulty, not only in practice, even in theory, what's the difference between proprietary trading and a customer-related trade? I mean, even Adam Smith on the Butcher and the Baker, you know, you've got people are doing it for proprietary and customer service reasons. I think it's drawing the line in an excruciatingly difficult place, which is not to say that drawing the line is easy in other places. And because Volcker is a total ban, you'd effectively be saying to Barclays, you know, you cannot do that activity in your banking group at all. Whereas with ring fencing, you're saying you cannot do that in retail, but you can do that in rest of group, which is in some sense much less confrontational. Two other points. One is US banking is very different from UK banking. Remember again the 5x GDP versus 1x GDP point. I think the UK's got a much you know, even more alarming issue to address. And the further point is, even though Glass-Steagall has gone in the US, that was the 1930s law that provided for total separation between depository institutions and various kinds of investment banking. That got eroded and essentially repealed at the end of the 90s. But you do have an underlying structure, some of it again coming from the 1930s legislation, if any of you hear into all that, the Section 23 of the Federal Reserve Act, Regulation W, and other regulations made to give effect to that act, which do create, it's not exactly ring fencing, but some structures within bank holding companies and banking groups in the US. And if you only did Volcker in the UK without that other substructure, I think you'd be missing a big part of the plot. So Volcker is an addition to a set of regulations in the US. And all this leads me to think that a better question is, why not add Volcker to what we recommended? I would say not, actually. But I think there's a question there that the pro-Volcker people in the UK shouldn't be, in my view, should not be arguing that as an alternative to our proposals, but more as an addition. And it was striking that in the closing months, some of the UK banks, when they knew something structural was likely to happen, were urging us to adopt the Volcker rule as a kind of least bad structural thing for them. And I've been in some European discussions in the last few weeks where some people wanting to resist structural reform in Europe have said, oh, well, maybe we should just do the Volcker rule. So that's on Volcker. I'm going to breeze through the next lesson, the capital lesson. This is the need complementary to safer structures. And even if you're not doing structure, you've got to have massively more, you've got to be on a credible path to massively stronger capital buffers and with loss absorbent debt than we had in the run-up to the crisis. Great debate. The bank said that this costs us a fortune to have higher capital. They said, we've got to give our equity holders 15% return on equity. We can borrow very, very cheaply. And we would say, yeah, but you can borrow in a way that's backstopped by the taxpayer. And it isn't that wedge a reflection of that? And the sharpest way of putting this, which Martin Wolf did to great effect on a few times, he said, look, when I have a banker come to me and say needs to give a 15% return, real return to equity holders, I look in the newspaper, what's the risk-free rate? Well, it's about zero. That banker is condemned out of his or her own mouth because they're basically, if they've got to offer 15% to equity holders, then they must be a hell of a risky bank. And on those grounds, then in the public interest, they need a lot more equity, not less. But there's a great academic debate here around the Modigliani-Miller theorem. We have Modigliani come up this morning in a different context. We can talk about that later on or over the tea break if people would like to. We were unimpressed by the arguments that higher equity requirements were socially costly in a damaging way. We were, however, conscious that if you've got to get from very low capital levels over a period of years to substantially higher ones, and the transition at least starts in a very difficult macroeconomic situation, you have to be sensitive to that. You can't just say, oh, it's got to be 15% capital ratio instead of 5% by the end of next year. That would be extraordinarily damaging. And we were conscious of the geographical arbitrage risks too. But we recommended the Basel baseline, and I could go on and on about risk-weighted assets. I don't want to do that at length now. Basel baseline is to get by the start of 2019 to a 7% equity ratio. We were saying for the large UK banks that should be at least 10%. And on top of that, we wanted to ensure that there was a slab of debt that had a high likelihood of bearing loss in the event of a future crisis. So it would be, it needs to be longish term debt, otherwise it could be vulnerable to the equivalent of a bank run. It needs to be unsecured so that the bondholders really are at risk. And it needs to be subject to a regulatory power short of bankruptcy to write down the value of the debt or to flip it into equity. I say short of bankruptcy. The reason why all these bondholders came out whole was the place where they take loss is called bankruptcy, and governments would not let these banks go bankrupt. So the taxpayer got marched near the front of the queue of loss absorbency, and the bondholders got off very handsomely. And that hierarchy of loss absorption needs to change. Linked to that, the thing bottom left is we rather than have depositors rank equally with other bondholders, we propose that in the loss-bearing hierarchy that insured deposits, those backed by the government insurance scheme, those should be senior to other kinds of debt in insolvency. That gets the government and the taxpayer further away from the hook of loss-bearing. And it also has some relevance for principles for loss-bearing. It says people should not be worse off than in bankruptcy. Well, if you've got depositor preference, that counterfactual is a different one. So it plays in, if any of you into these bail-in debates going on, plays into that as well. Risk weights, the one point I do want to make, was going, why did leverage zoom? That's the black line. Why did leverage go up from multiple like 20 to 35, 40, 50? It's because in the run-up to the crisis, and it's laughable with hindsight, the estimated risk of the asset side of the bank balance sheets was going down and down. So the amount of capital they had to provide to back each kind of lending, they're saying, well, that's safer and safer and safer, so we can get by with less and less capital backing that lending, so we can do loads and loads more lending. And because of this huge fallibility of risk weights, we recommended that in addition to requirements specified in terms of risk-weighted assets, we have an aggregate cap on leverage. And in the Basel process, it's part of that. There moves towards a 3% leverage ratio. That still allows 33 times leverage. This is in the new sunlit uplands, which we're not going to get till 2019. And I've been talking to some people about that. They said 33 times leverage, that's no wonder we had a crisis. And I say, no, that's where we're trying to get to. So that's a measure that on our scheme, the 33 for the big UK banks would be a number like 25, which still makes me nervous. And I think, unfortunately, the UK, that's one of our recommendations that the UK government is not minded to accept, which I think is unfortunate, but it's up to them. Our job was just to write a report. Costs and benefits, it's a fantastically good idea to do what we recommended. And one reason is just that cumulative output loss. I mean, there's work by the BIS, which we're saying, you know, typical crisis, the median loss is 60% or so of a year's output. Now, our reforms do put some cost on the banks, do put some cost on the economy, but you know, even a tiny shift in either the probability of a crisis or the impact of a crisis conditional on one occurring, you don't have to shift that dial very much at all to come out ahead on any plausible cost-benefit analysis. So what's happened in the last year? Well, one thing, we've had the ongoing macroeconomic stresses. We've had the Eurozone crisis. It got really quite worrying in the last couple of months of our work. A lot of voices were saying, oh, you mustn't do any reform with all this going on. And we thought that was nonsense. The the fact that banks are delicate, that's why they've got to be reformed, not a reason for not reforming them. So we were unimpressed by some voices calling for those events to be a reason not to reform. The government and the opposition in the UK both responded very warmly to our recommendations, both when they were published and 3 months later when the government made its response in the formal response in the House of Commons. In June this year, they published their white paper on banking reform, accepting the essence and the bulk, but not everything, of what we recommended. And then on the 12th of October, so very recently, the draft bill was published. There's been action too on the competition front, but as I said, I'm parking that outside my remarks. I think on any reckoning, the UK government is being more radical than any other major country, and I would say that even relative to the US and Switzerland, this is on banking reform. They have stepped up back from what we recommended on the leverage cap and on some other issues on which we stand by our original recommendation. There are some other things where they vary from what we recommended, where the government's probably right. There's only so much you can do in 15 months. For example, de minimis on balance, we thought it was best not to have a carve out for smaller banks. The government, I think with pretty good reason, has said, yes, there should be one. So there are a number of changes that I think are entirely reasonable, but we're not so sure about those. And in fact, this direct selling of derivatives by retail banks, the government's now referred that to a parliamentary commission, so the government's moved back into neutral, officially anyway, on that one. This summer, we've had all these scandals. Do they shift the argument? I think they shift the politics quite helpfully for the pro-reform cause. I don't think they shift the argument in favour of full splitting rather than ring fencing. We've got this new commission chaired by Andrew Tyrie MP, which I got to appear before on Monday, which is looking at two things: the whole question of banking standards given the crisis, and culture, things like that. And they are doing the pre-legislative scrutiny of the draft legislation to implement banking reform. So that's a pretty important commission. It's drawn both from the Commons and the Lords. Very interesting member of that is Nigel Lawson, Lord Lawson, who, as I'm sure nearly all of you know, was Margaret Thatcher's Chancellor of the Exchequer. He is a full splitter. So the banking reform is not a left versus right issue in the UK. And I think that's quite good. So it's not been party political, though there's a big range of views out there. Now, what should Europe do? Well, on every trip to Frankfurt, Brussels, everywhere else, I've said, absolutely not for me to say. We were making recommendations for the UK, et cetera, et cetera. Pause, however. So so skip the previous bit. I think there's an incredibly strong case for greater loss absorbency, and I mean greater than Basel baselines, not just greater than where we have been. I think certainly in relation to the big continental European banks, there's a very strong case for having some structural reform as part of the reform package. And yet this wasn't in the debate at all until a year ago. So we were 3 years on from the peak of the crisis, and structural reform of European banks was a sort of, you know, not an issue that people or the policy circles raised. Then Commissioner Barnier, European Commissioner Barnier, before the European Parliament, said he would set up an expert group to look at this very question. That's the Liikanen group, which I mentioned. And I think the cynics thought this would be a solemn inquiry that would conclude that nothing should be done. On the contrary, they've come out with proposals which I think in essence are very similar to where we've been. It's ring fencing, so structured legal entities but allowed within a wider banking group. But what Liikanen have done is to ring fence the trading activity rather than the retail. Is this a difference? My ICB colleague Martin Taylor was before the Tyrie Commission a week ago, and he said, in his view, not really a difference. He said, we're putting a fence around the deer park. Liikanen's putting a fence to keep the wild animals away from the deer. So it's essentially the same. I think it's a little bit more complicated than that, but it was a good good soundbite. I don't know if he made it up on the spot or not. Another, for me, very pleasing thing about Liikanen is even though their exam paper had questions only about structure, they said a lot about loss absorption, about risk weights in relation to property lending, about capital backing trading activities, about bail-inable debt, etc. So they're very much of the package of structure and loss absorbency, which is what we had. So far as I can understand it, Liikanen and the ICB in the UK are largely in harmony. There are some differences. I haven't quite fathomed out where they are and how serious they are. Not saying it's identical, but in spirit, philosophy, economic argument, very, very similar. Like our report, it's only a report, and it's now into the European Commission and member state community for a debate on this, so I've got even more trips to Brussels and places coming up. But the European debate on structure is now in this new phase. It's in the context of the banking union debates in Europe. My feeling about that is a banking union between well-capitalized and well-structured banks is one thing, quite a sensible thing. Banking union without those conditions could just end up as further mutualization of losses to the detriment of risk-taking incentives for the future. So I see these things very relevant to the banking union debate, not separate. And my final question, is it time for a wider global, not just European, debate on structural reform in banking? And I say that in part because the IMF very recently in the Global Financial Stability Report, which is the companion to the WEO that Stan was talking about yesterday, they're very explicit about the need for a global debate on business models in banking and finance generally. And Christine Lagarde in recent speeches has been quite emphatic about that. So just maybe we will have that ahead of us. Thank you.